Welcome.
Welcome.
Welcome to the Think Orange podcast.
A podcast with ideas and conversations to help you influence the next generation.
Here are your hosts, Dave Adamson and Ashley Bohens.
Hey, how's it going, everyone? My name is Dave, and I am so glad that you've decided to spend a little bit of time with us right here on the Think Orange podcast. As always, I am joined by the one and only Ashley.
What's up?
How are you doing?
I'm great.
Ash, can you believe that is the end of January already?
No, I feel like it flew by.
It totally flew by the last 4 weeks.
1 month down, Dave, 11 to go. So I hope you have not broken your New Year's resolution.
I don't make New Year's resolutions, so I haven't broken anything. What about you?
I don't break anything either.
Come on. You haven't broken any New Year's resolutions?
Well, no.
Have you settled back into time here in America yet? I know the last time you were still getting over a little bit of jet lag.
I'm doing better than I was last week.
I'm actually loving
how early I wake up, though, because nobody's awake for me to talk to, so I can get a lot done.
So you get to see the sunrise. You get to get out and get the day started when it's all bright and early, right?
I do.
That's so awesome. Yeah. I'm glad to hear that, because you are constantly doing new things and building new things, and that's kind of what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be talking about some tips for building a successful family ministry, specifically in a startup church. Now, this is going to suit everybody, not just startup churches, because these are such good tips, right?
They are. I think the three challenges that startup churches are facing, or not even just startup churches, because churches who have been in existence for years.
It's any church.
It's the common struggle of, I don't have enough people, I don't have enough money, and I don't have enough space. Yeah. So what do I do?
Yeah. I think that's any church size, whether you're a startup, you're established, whether you're huge or whether you're small, I think they're three very good things. Well, they're three very real things anyway. So we're going to be addressing those things today, and we're going to start off by hearing from a guy named Brian White, who's one of the elders at Discovery Church in Simi Valley, California. Now, I thought that was a mistake, that it was Silicon Valley, but it's Simi Valley, California. Do you know what that's near?
I have no idea where that is. I know where California is, though.
Well, it's right near Disneyland.
Woo!
And in fact, Brian works for Disney as well.
He's a hero because Disney is one of my favorite things ever.
I know. You're the biggest Disney fan I think I know, like legitimately.
Aww. I love that badge of honor.
What is your favorite Disney movie?
Well, I would say The Little Mermaid, Lion King, and Frozen are my favorites.
I've seen The Lion King. I've seen Frozen. I've never seen The Little Mermaid.
You are missing out, friend.
Really?
Not only is it one of the best Disney movies, but... Oh, gosh. You know what? Beauty and the Beast is also up there. But anyways, back to Little Mermaid. It's like one of the best soundtracks ever.
Never heard it.
It is so good.
I could not even hum one of the songs from The Little Mermaid. I couldn't even tell you a title of one of the songs. Maybe Brian wrote one of the songs.
If Brian wrote one of these songs, then we're going to need to have him on this podcast more often.
Like one of what songs? Which song? Which is your
favorite?
The first
one that pops to mind is, look at this stuff. Isn't it neat? Wouldn't you think my collection's complete? Wouldn't you think I'm the girl who has everything?
I love how you don't give the title, you just start singing it.
I don't know the title.
That's so good. Well, he's going to be talking specifically about some lessons that he's learned from Disney and how they can apply to a startup or a small church when it comes to family ministry. So that you're excited about that one already, right?
I am, because people who work for Disney are super creative. And when you don't have resources, you need to be creative with what you have.
That is so true. Hey, another person who's creative, who we're going to be having a conversation with, is Mr. Jeff Surratt. Now, I know that you know his wife really well, which is probably the thing he's most known for. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, Sherry serves as the executive director of parent strategy at Orange.
Yeah.
And she is one of the most wise women I have ever met in my life.
She is. We've had her on the podcast a couple
several times.
So I'm going to say she's officially a friend of the pod.
She is.
It's been a while since I've given that tag out. So Sherry is officially a friend of the pod. Now, her husband is who we're talking to today. I actually had a chance to catch up with him during the Orange tour. Jeff is a church planter. He's also a consultant, and he's doing a lot of work with Orange at the moment, helping us resource startup and smaller churches. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. It's a big initiative here at Orange.
Yeah. So before we hear from any of them, I want to let you know that today's sponsor is the Orange Conference, which is a three-day conference that happens here in Atlanta, Georgia. I know that you play a huge role in this, Asha. Tell us a little bit about the Orange Conference.
Well, we have approximately 10,000 people-ish that come from around the world, and they're, you know, preschool leaders and elementary leaders, volunteer small group leaders, student pastors, executive team members of the church. And so really, like, family ministries can attend this conference together, because we have tracks for all of the different roles that exist on your family ministry team, so that everybody can align and you can go back and have conversations about what you learn.
And this year's theme is becoming one voice. One voice. So this is going to help you realign your team, increase your influence, and communicate more clearly with one end in mind. This is a great opportunity to grow and connect as a team by attending the Orange Conference 2018, hashtag OC18. And you can find out more simply by going to theorangeconference.com. That is theorangeconference.com. It's also a great place, we talked about this last time, where you can win two free tickets to the Orange Conference. And if you win those tickets, what are we going to do, Ash?
You're going to be on the pod with us.
You're going to, we should get a t-shirt that says friend of the pod.
Oh, we totally
should. We should totally do that.
Hey guys, it's Kevin. Hey everybody. I agree with them. I'm really excited that they're excited. The entire podcast seems excited. And I hope you win. Because if you win, you'll be on the podcast. And you know, who better, you know, to get you a shirt than Dave? Because
I like how he threw that back, you know, on me.
When I think about it, what's going to happen, you're not going to get a shirt. You're going to get a shirt of a picture that Dave takes of you on the shirt. So it's going to be a picture
of you. Or a picture with Dave's face.
Oh, we should get shirts made with our faces.
And it says friend of the pot on the back.
Friend of the pot on the back.
I love it. And guess who's going to make it? Dave Adams is going to make you a shirt. I cannot wait for you to see what Dave cooks up.
Except if we get 10 reviews that request these t-shirts, I think that Kevin should get them.
Yes, I agree.
At least 10 reviews.
If we get 10 reviews.
I need more than that.
All right. Hey, how many reviews would it take?
It's going to take 50.
50 reviews. 50, if we get 50 reviews.
50 new reviews.
From January 10 through to, let's say the end of February. If we get 50 new reviews, we will look at all of those reviewers' names, and they go into the draw to get a
friend of the pod t-shirt.
Friend of the pod t-shirt.
Now mind you, guys.
This is escalating.
Yeah, it is escalating. And I just want to be candid. So I've done a couple of these giveaways before. And I know that sometimes when you ask people their shirt sizes, it makes you feel a little uncomfortable.
Okay.
So we might start with a friend of the pod mug to make sure we'll figure it out, because maybe you'll listen to your, I don't know. I just want to make sure people feel comfortable.
How about this? How about this? Let's just settle this once and for all. If we get 50 reviews, we will give away one friend of the pod mug. And if we get 100 new subscribers, we'll give away a mug and a t-shirt.
Something like that.
Done. I love how committal he was. Committal or committed? Committed?
Whatever you want. It's your world.
He was very committed in that whole thing. Kevin,
totally. Hey, guys, I'm happy that we have hosts who are so excited to bless you and thank you for your engagement.
Yes.
And I want to. And
our faces on
and we want to thank you by putting our face on your shirt everywhere you go for the week.
It's going to be so good.
Oh, my gosh.
I think the picture of you should be you singing with like a mermaid. You should be a mermaid.
Anyway. That's so weird.
All right. We've gone off topic here. So we've gone back to mermaids, which is great, because we're going to throw right now to Brian White, who is one of the elders at Discovery Church and works for Disney. Take it away, Brian.
So the first lesson about Disney is Disney thinks orange. It might sound weird, but it's true. What you need to do to realize this is think about how Walt Disney came to the idea of building Disneyland in the first place. And what happened was in the late 1940s, kind of mid-1940s, Walt had two daughters, and he would take them to amusement parks in Los Angeles on Saturday. And what he would do is kind of sit at the park bench, and he would watch them play. And he noticed a few things about these parks. And I think there's maybe a slide up here about maybe an amusement, yeah, amusement park. Walt would sit and read the paper. He'd watch his daughters play, and he saw a few things. First of all, there's boredom in the faces of the parents, right? They're just sitting on park benches watching their kids play. The other thing that he saw was relatively cheerless and unfriendly ride operators. They're just not happy to be there, didn't like their job. And then the other thing he noticed was old equipment, aging grounds, and just basically dilapidated kind of experience. Nothing new, nothing great. So the quote that's up here on the screen is from Walt Disney, and here it is. It says, "As I'd sit there while they rode the merry-go-round and did all these things, I'd sit on a park bench eating peanuts. I felt there should be some kind of an amusement enterprise built where the parents and the children could have fun together." That's 60 years ago. It sounds obvious to us now because we've all been to Disneyland, but this is a revolutionary idea in the late 40s. The catalyst for Disneyland was actually rooted in a simple idea: parents and children having fun together. This is a picture of my brother and my nephew. So you could say Disney was thinking orange, that the company he built was orange. He didn't use the word orange, but he was orange. It was an orange thinker that Disney was, and we still are to this day. The most powerful experiences in a child's life are the ones that the child will spend with parents. And Disney knows that, and we all know that in this room. I think the application for churches is that churches have to deliberately design environments where parents and children can experience Christ together. If you don't do that, then you're missing something. And that's what's so phenomenal about the orange experience and what you can do at your church. The next lesson is one of the biggest things that the Walt Disney Company in modern times deals with. And the lesson is, honor the past without living in it. This is a really difficult area to navigate if you work for any company that has a heritage. And the dilemma goes something like this. If we completely live in the past and we make all Disney products like Disney products that appeared before and it's all about nostalgia, then the world will eventually pass us by. But if we strike out in a totally new direction and jettison everything that has made us who we are, then we can also risk losing everything. So how do you honor the past without living in it? Well, the first thing is Walt didn't have a huge nostalgia. That wasn't something that drove him. There's a quote up here on the screen, and this is Walt. He says, "In this business of ours, we can ill afford to rest on our laurels, even to pause in retrospect. Times and conditions change so rapidly that we must keep our aim constantly focused on the future." So if you walk down Main Street and you think, wow, it's very nostalgic, yes, but Walt, when he looked at his company, was not nostalgic. He was thinking about 5, 10, 20 years in the future. He lived in the future. And he definitely was not about nostalgia. He started out by making cartoons that were 5 and 10 minutes long, and he could have stopped there, but he didn't. He made full-length feature animated films. He could have stopped there, but when he was 50 years old, he decided to build Disneyland. That happened when he was 50. And he could have just said, well, I'm a millionaire, I'm making the best movies ever, I've got my legend established, but no. He decided to make a theme park. Walt was restless, and he had a creative spirit, and he never rested on his laurels. And I think that's really one of the basic things. Right up on the screen is a picture of Mickey Mouse over the years. You can see how he's changed. He's evolved to make him more cute to the human eye. Anthropologists will tell you that as kids are cute to us because they have really big heads and really small bodies. And well, you can see that Mickey Mouse evolved over the years. And I'm sure there were people that told Walt, you can't change Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse is who defines your company. But he did, and he did for a good reason. And you can see now, if Mickey looked like how he does on the left, he'd be kind of funky looking to us. And he's kind of spindly, and you know, he's cute now. But sometimes, even with your most sacred thing, you need to challenge yourself and say, could it be better? And I think, you know, in line with Walt Disney's legacy, I'd like to talk a little bit about what the Disney Company has done in the last several decades since his death to innovate and to grow. So up on the slide here, you'll see Disney brought its classic movies to the medium of home video in the 1980s. There were a lot of naysayers that said, bad idea, keep them going to the theaters. They ventured into cable TV and launched the Disney Channel in 1995. A lot of people said, that's a bad idea. You don't do TV. Why would you be able to do successful TV? But Disney did it. And it happened just at the time that cable television started, so Disney rode that wave. They could have missed it. They also became a Tier 1 broadcaster by purchasing ABC and ESPN in 1996. There's a lot of people out there who actually don't know that Disney owns ESPN and that Disney owns ABC, but they do. They also took full control of their web presence. A lot of companies hired a lot of web companies in the late 90s to do their websites. Disney actually spent hundreds of millions of dollars to buy startup companies so that they could take full control of their web experience and Disney.com. They also expanded the footprints of their parks to include Asian and European parks. They have resorts all over the world, and they also have their own cruise line, which now has 4 ships in it. And also, more recently, Marvel. Disney purchased Marvel in 2009 for $4 billion, with a B, dollars. And why would they do that? Well, there's this feeling that they were missing the sort of demographic of teenage boys and young male adults. Now, you could spend decades trying to hit that demographic with your products, but it was really a great match that Disney bought Marvel. Now, Marvel can have a lot of things going for it that they couldn't have otherwise, and Disney can hit a demographic that they weren't hitting very well. So Disney has taken huge risks in the last several decades since Walt's death. And I think honoring the past without living in it, it's a real difficult thing to apply to your career, to your business, to your church. But, you know, we really, really struggle with it. This right here is a photo coming up of the Disney studio lot in Burbank. And you can see two things going on. First of all is the partner statue. This is in the center of the Disneyland parks. If you go to Disneyland, Disney World, you will see this statue. And there's a quote on the statue. And the quote says, "We must never forget that it was all started by a mouse." That's a Disney quote. And this building behind, in the background there, that's the executive building. That's where the CEO of Disney works, and that's where all of the high-level corporate guys work. And notice that the 7 dwarfs are there. The 7 dwarfs are holding up the company. Why? Because Walt Disney made a decision to make a movie in 1935 called Snow White and the 7 Dwarfs. And everybody who walks on that studio lot knows that it was that decision that defined decades of the company and what it would do. So we definitely honor the past. We know what the past is. But we also have to look towards the future at our company. So what's the thing that I would say is, you know, you really just have to think about whether you're honoring the past or whether you're living in the past at your church. I think that, you know, you could get into big trouble. And Disney actually did get into big trouble once by not embracing the future. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about that. It's not a story that a lot of people know, but here it goes. It's kind of hard to tell because it was a missed opportunity. So in the early 80s, there was a young animator that worked at Disney, and his name was John. And he worked on the studio lot, and on the other side of the studio lot, they were making a movie called Tron. And he walked over and saw what they were doing with computers on that movie, and he said, "I would love to explore how to make movies with computers, animated movies with computers." So he got approval from his bosses, and he started messing around, and the project that he started messing around with was Brave Little Toaster. It was a book that had come out. So at one point, he has this Brave Little Toaster. He's ready to show the CEO of Disney. It wasn't Walt. Walt had already been dead for many years, and Michael Eisner had yet to take the control of the company. This was kind of in those interim years. So Brave Little Toaster, the young animator walks in and he's showing the CEO how you can make a movie out of an animated movie out of using computers. And the CEO sort of stopped and said, "You know, how much quicker could you make a movie if you used computers compared to regular animation, traditional animation? And also, how much more money, you know, how much money would you save if you used computers to make an animated movie instead of the traditional way?" And the young animator looked at the CEO and he said, "Well, it'd probably be about the same amount of cost and probably take the same amount of time. I don't think there's any monetary value in pursuing us directly monetary or in terms of time. So the CEO ended that meeting and called the young animator into his office later that day and fired him from Disney. He got fired. Why? Well, first of all, his idea was kind of scary to a lot of the artists. A lot of the artists did things a certain way at Disney, and this guy was kind of coming in saying, I have a totally new way. And imagine if you'd been an artist in the 50s and 60s, and then some new whippersnapper comes in, and he's got computers, and you're sitting there doing things a certain way. That's pretty scary. And the second thing is that the leadership at Disney at the time, they were thinking about costs, and they were thinking about timelines. They weren't thinking about the best products. So, what happened? Well, this guy, John, he went up north, and he got a job with George Lucas. He was in a small group that was exploring animation technology using computers. And a few years later, George Lucas wasn't sure what to do with those guys, so he sold those guys and all of their technology to Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple. And then they decided to name their new company Pixar. And this guy, John, he took over the creative control of all Pixar products. And eventually, companies like Disney started to realize there was some huge talent and there was something here with Pixar. So what happened is Michael Eisner, the CEO at the time, he made a three-picture deal with Pixar. And he said, I'd like you guys to make full-length feature animated movies using computers. And we'll split the profits 50-50 because you guys make the movie, we'll distribute them, we'll get the marketing going on, we'll have characters at the theme parks. So you have movies, you know, Toy Story, and these the first three Pixar movies. And they did really, really well. They did so well that a few years later, when it was time to renegotiate the contract, it didn't go so well. Pixar said, we don't like 50-50. And what happened, actually, is everyone started to worry. Is it possible Pixar might start doing business with DreamWorks or might start doing business with Warner Brothers? And at that time, as this crisis hit, the CEO, Michael Eisner, he stepped down. And a new CEO named Bob Iger took over. And the first thing Bob Iger did, instead of recommence negotiations, is he said to Pixar, I'd like to buy you. I'd like to buy your company. And so on January 24th, 2006, Disney purchased Pixar for $7.4 billion. And the young animator who the Disney company fired in the 80s was John Lasseter. He's the chief creative officer of the Disney company now. That's his new title. The things that got him fired in the 80s from Disney are now what makes him the chief lead creative guy. And he actually holds the title that Walt Disney held when Walt Disney ran the company. So, what's the lesson? Well, there's a big lesson here, right? Disney was able to purchase Pixar. That was good. It was the right decision. But it's clear, when an organization is afraid to take bold risks and chooses to live in the past, the cost in terms of finances, frustration, momentum, they can be staggering. And I think churches have the same lesson. The world's in constant change. New technologies are coming every day. And the old way of doing things doesn't always work in today's day and in the future. If you're in church and they're afraid to embrace the future, or maybe even worse, they're afraid to embrace the present, then you'll probably see your organization pay a significant cost. That price might be declining membership. You might see fewer people joining on Sunday mornings. That price could be an inability to reach the younger generation for Christ. That price could be a few years later looking around in your town and seeing a church that did embrace the future and they're thriving. And you're sitting there wondering what happened. Honoring the past is definitely something that's important, but please don't live in the past. I've been to a lot of churches in Europe and they're beautiful. They have stained glass, they've got pipe organs, they've got histories that would put to shame any American church, maybe in some cases, but pretty much they're empty. They're museums. It's really sad. And I would just hope that, you know, the church that I go to would never want to live in the past and suffer that fate. You want to honor the past, but please don't live in it.
Okay, I'm sitting across the table from Jeff Surratt. Now, Jeff, I've heard that you're a tribe leader. I heard that you're an interim pastor. I've heard a whole... How do you define what you do? What is the thumbnail version of your resume?
I'm just kind of the Superman of church.
The leadership. Superman of church.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at.
That is the best title ever.
I actually do a lot of different stuff. I can't keep a job and I can't stick with one thing at a time. So what I do with most of my time right now is I am interim lead pastor at a church in Denver. What I went to that church to do is help them with startup churches and with multiplication.
Yep.
And they went through a leadership crisis, so they asked me to step in for a little while. And then with Orange, what I love doing is just an opportunity to work with startup churches as they're trying to figure out how to use the Orange strategy as they get started.
So you've worked with churches of all different shapes and sizes in all different contexts from a state community sort of point of view. What is it that successful churches are doing when it comes to implementing some sort of successful family ministry?
You know, one of the things I think is most important, it kind of starts with a pastor. So if you have a lead pastor who is committed to actually partnering with families, so instead of just seeing their church as a opportunity to get people in the door, and we'll have a little children's ministry on the side so that I can talk to the adults. Mm. I see a lot of, especially younger lead pastors who have younger kids, seeing that ministering to the family is actually the main thing that they want to do.
Yep.
And so they make it central to what they're doing from even before they start the church. So they start thinking about, how do we minister to the families in our neighborhoods?
Yep.
How do we reach out to our next door neighbors and not just to manipulate them to get to church, not that anyone would use the word manipulate, but how do we become friends with our neighbors, get to know them, learn where their challenges are, and out of that kind of comes the strategy for the church.
So Jeff, we have a whole bunch of different people who listen to this podcast, and I'm sure there are people right now who agree with everything you just said, that it all starts with the lead pastor who has that sort of mindset, but maybe they're working in the children's ministry and they feel like their lead pastor doesn't have that mindset. What advice would you give that person on how to get their lead pastor to come around to the importance of family ministry?
It's probably best just to give up.
Find somewhere else to go
No, not at all. I've been in church ministry for about 35 years, most of that time not in the lead pastor seat. And so I understand that completely. I think the biggest thing that you can do if you're in a children's ministry seat or in a student ministry seat is to continually... feed's probably the wrong word, but to continue to share with your lead pastor stories of what God's doing through what you're already doing in family ministry. Mm. Instead of saying, hey, why can't we do this and why can't we do that? Lead pastors tend to respond to stories of life change happening in families, and then they want to lean into that. They want to see, they want to feed that. So the biggest thing I think you can do when you're not in a lead seat is constantly be looking for those stories and sharing those stories, especially in a context where the pastor might be able to use those stories in some context within a sermon or within telling the broader story of the church.
So I think that that's great. I think that's great advice. For people who are listening going, they agree with you. Is there a way that you would advise somebody, if you're sitting across the table from somebody and pitching that advice and they say, well, how do I do that? How do I share that story? Because a lot of times, I would say a lot of student ministers, people in the student ministry world, feel like they've only got an elevator pitch as they're passing the senior pastor in the hallway. Is there another way? Is there something you advise them to do to share those stories?
Yeah, absolutely. One is don't miss your elevator pitch as you're passing the lead pastor. Don't waste it on other things, you know, and don't make it manipulative. But what I, you know, this is a very, very simple thing, but email is an awesome way to talk to a lead pastor, but do it very quickly, succinctly. Don't give them the War and Peace version.
Yeah.
Give them the one paragraph version. In journalism, they taught you not to bury the lead. Don't put it down in. If it's not a, hey, pastor, you need to know what's going on, but instead it's, man, you won't believe what happened last night at youth group. I just wanted to share with you, this kid said this, or hey, I was hanging out with one of our families and they shared with me this is going on, and I just thought you'd want to know that.
Yeah.
I don't know lead pastors who don't want to hear that that kind of thing and won't respond.
I would imagine that potentially social media is a good way to do it as well. If the ministry, the student ministry, has a Facebook page and people are encouraged to share their stories, then you can just take a screen snap of that and send it in.
Oh, email. Yeah. I thought for a minute you thought that the lead pastors would read the student ministry Facebook page.
No,
that's not happening.
Let's assume they're not doing that. But it's a great way for somebody, a family, to tell tell their story. Yes. If you give them the opportunity to share their own story, then you can just pass that on.
Yeah. And a lot of churches probably do this. What we're doing at our church is we don't rely on the families to do that. We go out and get the stories. So we have a very, very part-time person that she's constantly looking for those stories. And then she goes to the family. She gets the picture. She gets the story. She posts it. And then that is what is then shared with the lead pastor because it's already kind of curated.
That's so great. What do you call that position?
They're just our social media director.
I love that idea of sending them out to grasp those stories. It's almost like a newsroom.
Right.
Right? You're sending the reporter out into the field to grab the story.
Right. You guys know at Orange, and I'm sure people listening know as well, people aren't always good at telling their stories, even if they're compelling. So we just help them tell their stories.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so now the same question from the opposite side. If you're a lead pastor who's listening to this and you know the value of family ministry, but you don't know how to get it started, what's your advice to a senior pastor?
You should buy everything Orange offers. I mean, that's what we're here for, right? It's a sales. No, here's the deal. I don't actually work for Orange. I do some work with Orange and love Orange. I've loved Orange since the beginning. And this isn't a sales thing, but there are some incredible resources that lead pastors don't always understand what's available there and understand what's going on. So honestly, if I'm a lead pastor, a couple of things I'm going to do, I am a lead pastor, a couple of things I am doing is one, I'm trying to understand what's available, whether it's Orange or whatever I'm using, to understand what is it we're teaching? What is it we're using? What are the resources that we use in family ministry? Another thing that I'm trying to do is I'm trying to volunteer in family ministry. So when I'm not speaking, we have a teaching team at our church. So when I'm not speaking, I'm in trying to get in with the elementary and teaching in the elementary or being in the baby row or whatever that's called at your church, but trying to actually be around what we're doing in family ministry. I'm constantly hanging out with our youth pastor, asking him what's going on, what's good, what stories do you have? And so as a lead pastor, I'm being proactive of trying to understand, okay, so what is going on and how can we platform that?
Yeah, that's great. Hey, if I can get you to take your lead pastor hat off for a moment, put your church planter hat back on. I know I've heard you in some breakouts talk about the importance of a church planting in a community to get to know the community. What do you mean by that?
So my context is in the West. It's in Denver, Colorado. Yep. We have a lot of church plants that get started. A lot of startup churches come to Denver. And a mistake that we see happen is a lot of these guys will move from another part of the country and they'll read the newspaper or they'll read the demographic information. They'll sit around a coffee shop for a little while and they'll think that they understand who we are as a community. And the reality is they don't. They just have a very surface view. So when I'm working with startup churches and startup church planters, the thing I say is you've got to move into the community, you got to live in the community, you got to hang out with your neighbors, you've got to spend many months, usually a year before you even want to try to plant a church, simply being a part of the community because for the first two or three months, you're just going to hear the surface things. After that, as you are involved in the school and you're involved in some of the community things going on, you're talking to the school administrators, you're talking to the teachers, you're going to begin to understand the layer beneath what you actually see. And that's when you're beginning to actually understand the community that you're in.
I imagine doing those sorts of things has the potential to change a church's mission. Like you might come in with a vision or a certain mission, but if you get to know your neighborhood, it's okay that vision changes a little bit, right?
Yes and no. It's just terminology. What I talk about is the basic mission really doesn't change, but the model changes. And so what happens is we fall in love with a model. We'll go to a church, a North Point or a Life Church or whatever, and we'll love that model.
Yeah.
And then we'll want to impose that model on our community. Well, the model doesn't always connect. Yeah. So the mission needs to not be so tied into how we fulfill the mission.
Yeah. Well, Andy Stanley says, right, marry the mission, date the model.
Well, Andy's a pretty smart guy, so that's probably where I got that idea from. Yeah.
We'll just claim that as yours now,
there we
Jeff.
Go. Yeah,
because you basically just said the same thing. What do you see some of the biggest, for church planters who are listening, what are some of the biggest issues you find that they face in the first couple of months?
You know, for church planters, what we always talk to them about, one is just being brutally honest, you can never have too much money when you start a church plant. I mean, a lot of our guys come in underfunded, and so they really struggle there. Another issue that they face early on is building a launch team, building a team that is very connected to the mission that they have, that is willing to do the work that it takes to really be a part of the community, and then just discouragement. One of the things we talk about, and I won't tell the story, but there's a Mike Tyson quote from many years ago. Mike Tyson, the boxer, once was before a fight, the guy he was going to fight said, I have a plan. I know what I'm going to do to beat Mike Tyson. And they asked Tyson, well, what do you think about that? And Mike Tyson said, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. And what we have discovered with church planters is they always get punched in the face. It always happens. It happens through not enough finances, the launch team, things happen in their family. And the question is always, can they get back up after they're punched in the face? And so, yeah, that's the biggest thing that they face, is just this discouragement after a couple, 3 months, and it doesn't look like they thought it was going to look.
So I want to take that boxing analogy a little bit further. I've got some friends who are church planters. A really good friend of mine is currently in the first year of planning a church. And as I watch him, what I sense from him is that sometimes when you're in the ring, you get punched in the face, the bell goes and the round's over. And when you go back to your corner, there's nobody sitting there. Nobody sitting there to help you, patch you up or anything like that. Do you find that there are a lot of church planters who feel like they're just alone?
Absolutely. And that's one of the biggest things I talk to guys about. I'd say never plant alone. And it's because of that. That's a great, I hadn't thought of the analogy in that way, but you're exactly right. You've got
copyright Dave Adamson.
As Dave said one time. Yeah, no, I'm with you there 100%. I think that's the biggest thing that stops church planters. They don't have anybody in their ring, and two, they don't have the support that they need behind them. Yeah. I think the most successful church plants are guys who plant with some sort of network, whatever that looks like.
Yeah.
And the very successful guys have a local church that is there. Even if the local church isn't given money or anything else, they're there to be there for them, to support them, to come around them.
Yeah.
Those are huge factors.
Yeah. So if I'm about to plant a church, I've got, say I'm part of some sort of church planning network, whatever that looks like. Say I've got the money. Say I've been living in the community for a year. My wife and I have become integrated into the community. My kids are in the schools. We're on school board. We do all of that. What's the first thing, as soon as I open my doors, let's say maybe the first three things you think that I should have in place, ready to go?
On day one.
On day one.
When you launch your...
When I launch.
When you launch your church.
Yeah.
Gosh. It's hard not just to go to... I'm sorry. It's hard not to just go to the basics. I mean, unfortunately, in America, it still matters whether or not the communicator is effective or not. So one of the things you got to ask as a church planter, if you're going to be the lead church planter and if you're going to be the one speaking, are you any good? And so that's one of the things I just ask. I mean, how do you know you're good? And not because mom thinks you are, not because your wife thinks you are, but do people respond to your teaching? If not, then can you leverage something, you know, North Point does strategic partner type things where you use Andy's teaching.
Yeah.
Life Church does the same kind of thing. Is somebody else the lead teacher? Do you have, I have a church planner. I know this is super basic, but I have a church planner friend that we helped launch that has struggled for his first year and a half. And one of the reasons is he never found anyone who could actually lead worship, like could sing on key and stuff. And that's people really, after a few weeks of like the guitar not being tuned and not singing on key, it's really hard to stick around. And so that's been
good
a challenge
for sticking around for a couple of weeks.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And then gosh, children's ministry is a tricky one. Cause here's what I see over and over again is guys start and they've got all the right equipment. They've got the right curriculum. They've got, you know, people lined up to be in the room, but they don't actually have a strategy for families beyond that. And I'm not saying that just because we're, you know, involved in an Orange podcast. I really, really believe that.
Yeah.
So everybody figures out the preaching thing. Everybody kind of figures out the music thing. Very few of them figure out how do we actually have a family strategy where we're going to be reaching, not just doing good kids stuff on Sunday, but we're actually going to have a strategy that partners with parents all through the week. And as I see planters beginning to understand that, I'm beginning to see really getting traction in that area.
Yeah. And those three things that you just said, communicators, worship leaders, and family, I see that successful churches have all of those things in place but they didn't always. They started somewhere. Even Andy Stanley talks about how he used to, when he preached, he would always get a tape, I think, in the early days, and he would drive around listening to himself preach to figure out what he needed to improve on. He surrounded himself with good musicians who could sing in key and knew how to tune a guitar. But also at North Point, you know, I'm blessed enough to have my kids going to North Point, and they really do partner with us. It's a partnership. It's not just a thing that happens on, it's not babysitting. It's partnering with me so that I'm a better dad, so that I can lead my children in their spiritual formation.
Excellent.
It all starts somewhere, right? The big right. churches start somewhere.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And we ran into that. I used to work with a church in South Carolina where my job was to start new campuses.
Yeah.
And the original church had grown to about 4,000 or 5,000 people. So they yeah. had a high level of excellence, right? And so some of these campuses had 200 people in them, but the original campus was trying to hold the 200-person campus to the same standard of excellence that they had. And finally, our lead pastor had to come in and say, when we were 200, we were not even nearly as good as they are now.
Yeah.
So I think one of the, and just to jump off of what you're saying, for church planters, it can be very discouraging, honestly, yeah. to look at a North Point
yeah.
and to go, wow, they've got Andy Stanley speaking, you know, they've got this incredible worship. They've got these environments for kids that yeah. are unbelievable. And I love what you're saying. North Point didn't have that when North Point yeah. started. And so to not be discouraged by comparison,
yeah.
but to continually be improving.
Yeah, continually improving. I think that's the key, because church planters, as anybody in ministry, do you think we strive for perfection too much?
We can't go there. We don't have time.
It has
I think
to be
we
perfect.
Have, I think we, well, not just perfect. I think we worship at the altar of excellence.
Whoa. Hang on. Say that again.
Well, I think we worship at the altar of excellence. I yeah. think there was a time, I'm an old guy, so I remember when church was ratty old pews and hymn books that barely hung together. And so there was this movement against that, which I totally buy into and believe in. But we swung all the way over to excellent, where if it's not what we call excellent, which is often perfectionism in disguise, right?
Yeah.
If it's not that, then it's not good enough. And what happens is we are more concerned about having the best sound and the best lights and the best environments and this incredible excellence over here. And I'm not against excellence, but I think we lose sight of the real goal, which yeah. is to share the gospel with people and see them grow in their faith. And what we love is the excellence thing. And it makes us tingle when it's so cool and so awesome.
Yeah.
And I have said for a long time, I'm addicted to effective more than I am to excellence. And if I can be effective in connecting with people who are far from God, helping them take their next step in faith, and I can do it, and it's not what you might call excellent, I'm okay yeah. with that. I don't have a problem with that.
I really like that. Aim for effective, not excellence.
Yeah, don't ever use the phrase good enough, though, because that makes excellence addicts just yeah. twitch in their sleep.
And what I'm hearing you saying, though, is you're striving for improving, not striving for perfection.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. And there's a line that we used to call the good enough line. We changed it to the excellent enough line.
Yeah.
But there's a line of excellence, which above that line, you're not any more effective than you were before. You're not going to reach more people. You're not going to see people take more steps toward Christ, but you keep moving above that line because that's what you like. You're moving then toward perfectionism, right?
Jeff, this has been a great conversation. I really think you've helped a lot of people on all ends of the spectrum, whether church planters, lead pastors, or people in student ministry. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been great chatting with you, and you're going to work on that visa for me to Australia.
I'm trying to get you to Australia.
Perfect.
I think you may have just crossed over the age barrier, but we'll see. We'll see what we can do.
We'll work it out.
I'll put a call into the Australian Prime Minister.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks, mate. Well, that was such a great conversation with Jeff. I really enjoyed that. I love what he had to say about the importance of starting a church with a focus on building strong families. Mm-hmm. And that's any size church needs to have that strong family focus, don't you think?
Yeah, I think the focus being on a strong family, regardless of what the family looks like and the context of the family,
that's good.
Is so important. So not building a strong family, meaning they have to have two parents. It has to look like this.
Because it looks different.
But no matter what it looks like, how can we strengthen that family
yeah.
and that family dynamic?
Yeah, that's really good. I know for me, like as a, I don't work in family ministries. We all know that, but I do work for North Point. And as a parent of a family that attends one of our North Point churches, what I love is to see how my family has been being encouraged to grow in their faith by what the church is teaching my kids.
Yeah, I mean, the whole reason we're called orange is because you take the red, the color red, which represents the warmth and love of a family, and you take the color yellow, which represents the light of the church and of Christ, and together, the color yellow and red make the color orange.
Yeah, that's good.
And so the reason that we do that is because parents are the number one influence in every area of a kid or teenager's life.
Yeah.
I mean, on average, we always say that ministry leaders will get about 40 hours a year to influence a kid, where parents will get over 3,000.
Yeah.
And so I think the best way we can reach a kid is to help reach the whole family.
That's so good.
So that the church can influence the kid alongside the family. And we always say here that two combined influences always greater than two influences.
That is so good. In fact, I would say that that wrap up that you just did is worth the price of admission to this podcast alone. So thank you for sharing that. That was really, really, really good. Hey, we would love if you could share this podcast with some of your friends, maybe your ministry leaders, maybe other ministry leaders at other churches, right? Because all churches should be helping each other. So why don't you share it around a little bit? There's a couple of other things we love for you to do. What are they?
Subscribe to the podcast, wherever it is you listen to podcasts.
We totally want you to subscribe. And we also want you...
leave a review
and
mention the t-shirt.
Yes, leave a review, mention the t-shirts. Remember, we are trying to get 50 new reviews up in the month of February. And I think we said 50 new subscribers as well. And from that, we are going to create a Friend of the Pod t-shirt and or mug. And you could be the lucky recipient if you leave a review and if you subscribe to this podcast. So make sure you go ahead and do all of that. Hey, we can't wait to see you next week for another special episode of the Think Orange podcast. But in the meantime, whenever you think next generation,
think orange.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Think Orange podcast.
Join us next time for more ideas and conversations to help you influence the next generation.
For more episodes and show notes, visit thinkorangepodcast.com.